minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, X minus 1. Fire.
Lights out, everybody.
The creaking door.
Dimension X.
Inner Sanctum Mystery.
X minus one.
Dark fantasy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Horror, brought to you by Duane Old Time Radio. Sci-Fi and Horror features some of the best programs from the golden age of radio, including X-1, Orbiter X, Dimension X, Slot X's, Lights Out, Ray Bradbury, Dark Fantasy, and many, many more. Before we start today's sci-fi and horror thriller, if you enjoy what I'm doing, let me ask you to subscribe to my channel. Subscribing is 100% free, and you will receive notifications on new posts. And now, on to the show. CBS Radio Workshop is here for the week. And we have two episodes from CBS Radio Workshop. Their 16th episode, The Enormous Radio, May 11th, 1956. And then their 17th episode, Lovers, Villains, and Fools. Which one are you? Which one am I? You can be more than one. It's okay. Anyway, the story is Lovers, Villains, and Fools. 17th episode, and it aired May 18th, 1956.
To the balloon.
Perfect.
Indeed.
CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, The Enormous Radio, based on John Cheever's extraordinary short story, which originally appeared in the pages of the New Yorker magazine.
Irene, don't you want to hear the workshop? It's a pretty good show.
Oh, I feel like music, don't you? It's the Schubert Verallum, isn't it?
Yeah. All right, leave it on. A little louder, though, will you?
Jem and Irene Westcott were the kind of people who seemed to strike that satisfactory average of income, endeavor, and respectability that is reached by the statistical reports and college alumni bulletins. They differed from their friends, their classmates, and their neighbors only in an interest they shared in serious music. They went to a great many concerts, although they seldom mentioned this to anyone, and they spent a good deal of time listening to music on the radio. Now, their radio was an old instrument, sensitive, unpredictable, and beyond repair. And when it faltered, Jim would strike at the side of the cabinet with his hand. Well, this sometimes helped. But one Sunday afternoon,
darling,
hmm?
The radio.
Hmm? Oh, oh, Lord. No, this time it's finished.
Bang it again.
Oh, it's finished. It's just burned out.
It might not be. How do you know? Try reversing the plug or something.
But it won't do any good. It's a miracle it lasted this long.
Let me try.
That's not going to do any good, not...
The woman's touch.
All right. Why don't you sit down? It'll... Yeah. See, there it goes.
It's so aggravating. And of course it had to happen while they were playing the Schubert.
Take it easy.
Well, it makes me mad. We knew this was going to happen. We should have done something.
I told you what the repairman said, honey. It had cost almost as much to fix it as to buy a new one.
Darling, couldn't we get a new one?
I don't know. We agreed to get along with this until we could get a good hi-fi with some FM.
Please. It's not going to be much fun without music.
All right. All right, dear. I'll look around tomorrow, see what I can find.
The next day, on Monday, when he came home from work, he told her that he'd got one. He refused to describe it and said that it would be a surprise for her when it came. The radio was delivered the following afternoon, and with the assistance of her maid and the handyman, Irene uncrated
it. You hold this, Emma.
Oh, yes,
and
ma'am.
Brought it into the living room.
Take your stuff in the kitchen later.
Oh, this sure is a heavy
one. Not a very pretty cabinet.
Oh, ma'am, look at all the dials on it. I never could get the hang of that.
Well, it shouldn't be too difficult, I suppose. Volume, treble, boost, bass boost, tuning, shortwave, band, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, well, this must be the switch to turn it on. Yes. Plug it in now, will you, Emma?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
All right. Probably takes a minute to warm up.
Oh, my. It is loud, isn't it, ma'am? Much louder than the old one.
Yes. It'll take a little getting used to, tuning it in.
My, you certainly do know how to find good music, I'll say.
It is nice. Well, you'd better see about getting supper now.
Yes, ma'am.
She sat down to listen, feeling once again complete. The music came through clearly. The new instrument had a much purer tone, she thought, than the old one. Well, she decided that tone was most important, and she could conceal the ugly gumwood cabinet behind a sofa. But as soon as she'd made her peace with the radio, the interference began.
Oh, dear. And they call this hi-fi.
Nothing she did with the switches and dials dimmed the interference. As she sat down again, disappointed and bewildered, and tried to trace the flight of the melody. The elevator shaft in her building ran beside the living room wall, and it was the noise of the elevator that gave her a clue to the character of the static. The rattling of the elevator cables were reproduced in her loudspeaker. And realizing that the radio was sensitive to electrical currents of all sorts, she began to discern through the Mozart the various other sounds. By listening more carefully, she was able to distinguish doorbells, elevator bells, electric razors, and whirring mixers picked up from the apartments that surrounded her. The powerful and ugly instrument, with its mistaken sensitivity to discord, was more than she could hope to master, so she turned the thing off.
Hello?
Hello, Irene. Did it get there?
Oh, the radio. Yes, dear.
Oh, how do you like it?
Well, it's fine, but...
But what?
Well, there's all kinds of sounds, noises coming through.
What do you mean? Like static?
Well, yes, but more like real noises.
Hmm?
I think it's picking up all the electric things in the building. Bells, vacuums, telephones.
Well, you better not fool with it until I get home. It probably needs a ground or something.
All right. I think it's wonderful, dear. Much nicer than the old one. When it's clear, the music sounds beautiful.
Oh, good. Well, I'll see you later. Bye.
Bye.
When Jim Westcott came home that night, he went to the radio confidently, worked the controls.
Hello, Pop. What? Who's this? Hello.
The low pressure area, which developed over the southwest yesterday, is moving rapidly toward the north and east. With lower temperatures following.
What the devil? Time.
That's what I was telling you.
The city's current reading is 58. Kansas City, 54.
He fiddled with the knobs.
Chicago, 54. Detroit, 55.
Couldn't get rid of the noise.
And rainy. Toledo, 56.
And he turned the radio off.
What the heck with it, huh? I'll call the fellow who sold it to me in the morning. He's going to hear something from me.
The following day, Irene had a luncheon date and did some shopping during the afternoon. It was late when she returned home, and she didn't have a chance to turn on the radio, although the maid informed her that a man had come and fixed it. She busied herself with the children, seeing to their baths and bedtime. When Jim came home that night, he was tired and took a shower and changed his clothes, and then he joined Irene in the living room. He had just turned on the radio when the maid announced dinner, so he left it on, and he and Irene went to the table.
I saw the sweetest dress this afternoon. Of course, I didn't buy
it,
but...
Well, it's just as well. I mean, we better go slow for a bit.
Hard day, dear?
Yeah, and a rotten day.
Music does sound nice, doesn't it?
Very nice.
For heaven's sake, Kathy, do you always have to play the piano when I get home?
Well, it's the only chance I have. I'm at the office all day.
So am I. I wish you'd...
Did you hear that?
Yeah, but it's probably a play.
I don't think it is a play.
What's the matter? Where are you going?
I want to see what that was.
Well, try another station.
This country.
Hey, have you seen my garters?
Button me up.
I said, have you seen my garters?
Just button me up and I'll find your garters.
All right, all right.
Is that a radio show?
I don't know.
Here, let me see.
I wish you wouldn't leave apple cores in the ashtray. I hate the smell.
What the devil is this?
On the coast of Coromandel, where the early pumpkins blow, in the middle of the woods lived the Yongi Bongi Bo. Two old chairs and half a candle, one old jug without a handle.
Oh, that's the Sweeney's nurse.
What?
Turn that thing off. Maybe they can hear us. That was Miss Armstrong, the Sweeney's nurse. She must be reading to the little girl. They live in 17B. I've talked to her in the park. I know her voice. We must be getting other people's apartments.
That's impossible.
Look, that was Sweeney's nurse. I know her voice. I know it very
well.
All right,
now, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Lady Jingly, Lady Jingly, sitting where the pumpkins blow.
Maybe they can hear us.
Be my wife.
Okay.
I'm tired of living singly on this
Hello?
Coast so wild and singly.
Hello?
I'm a weary of my life. If you come and be my wife,
I guess she can't hear us. Try something else.
Right. Eat some more sandwiches.
Oh, sure, I'd love some.
Those must be the Hutchinsons in 15B. I knew they were giving a party this afternoon. I saw her in the liquor store.
Oh.
Isn't this divine? Try something else.
All right, wait a minute.
See if you
wait
can get
minute.
Those people in 18C.
The Westcotts overheard that evening a monologue on salmon fishing in Canada, a bridge game, running comments on home movies, and a bitter family quarrel about an overdraft at the bank. They turned off the radio at midnight, went to bed, weak with laughter. Sometime in the night, their son began to call for a glass of water, and Irene got one and took it into his room. It was very early. From his window, all the lights in the neighborhood were extinguished. He went into the living room and turned on the radio.
Are you all right, darling?
Yes. I'm all right, I guess. But you know, Charlie, I don't feel like myself anymore. Sometimes there are only about 15 or 20 minutes in the week when I feel like myself. I don't like to go to another doctor. The doctor bills are so awful already, but I just don't feel like myself, Charlie. I just never feel like myself.
Oh, dear. How sad. How terribly sad.
The following morning, after her children and husband had been carried away in the elevator, she went into the living room and tried the radio again.
are going to school this morning, my girl, and that's all there is to it. Look, we paid $800 to get you into that school, and you'll go if it kills you.
If you think he's so hot, why don't you just tell us?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I can just see you. You'd like that, wouldn't you? That's what you're waiting for. You'd like me to do something like that, the kind of thing you've been doing.
Huh?
You think I don't know? You think I don't smell that perfume on you when you get home from work? Work? You think I haven't seen the lipstick on your handkerchief?
That's the Johnsons.
You look in my pockets again, I'll break your arm. Thanks for a lousy breakfast and indigestion. I may see you tonight and I may not.
Go on. Get out. Go on. Stay out all night.
Maybe I will.
Irene shifted the control and invaded the privacy of several breakfast tables. She overheard demonstrations of indigestion, love, abysmal vanity, faith, and despair. Her life was nearly as simple and sheltered as it appeared to be, and the forthright and sometimes brutal language that came from this loudspeaker the morning there astonished and troubled her. She continued to listen until her maid came in, and then she turned the radio off quickly, since this insight, she realized, was a furtive one. She had a luncheon date with a friend that day and didn't get home until after 2:30. For some reason, she felt strangely disturbed.
Dear, I expected Miss Cummings.
No, she's out getting me some coffee, honey.
My, what an efficient secretary.
Something wrong?
No. You won't forget we're going out for dinner tonight.
No, I won't forget. Look, dear, I'm rather busy.
Oh, I'm sorry, dear.
No, that's all right.
Oh, the funniest thing.
What?
When I went out for lunch, there were some people in the apartment elevator. It was the funniest thing. I kept
honey,
wondering...
Honey, will you tell me about it later? I haven't got time now. I'll see you about 7.
Scotch to anyone who hasn't white hair. And see if you can get rid of that liver paste before you pass those hot things.
As the afternoon waned, the conversations increased in intensity. On her radio, she could hear the arrival of cocktail guests, the return of children and businessmen from their schools and offices. The voices swirled around her.
I found a good-sized diamond on the bathroom floor this morning.
What?
It must have fallen out of that bracelet Mrs. Dunstan was wearing last night.
Let me see it.
Here it is.
We'll sell it. We'll take it down to the jeweler on Madison Avenue and sell it. Well, Mrs. Dunstan won't know the difference, and we could use a couple of $100, I'll tell you.
No. How horrible.
Oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clemens. Halfpence and farthings, say the bells of St. Martin's. When will you pay me, say the bells at Earl Bailey.
It's not a hat. It's not a hat, it's a love affair.
Oh, that's what it was.
That's what Farrell said. He said it's not a hat, it's a love affair.
Talk to somebody, honey. Talk to somebody. If she catches you standing here not talking to anyone, she'll take us off her invitation list, and I love
well,
these
you
parties.
You know I hate these things. I think they stink.
I love them.
The Westcotts were going out for dinner, and when Jim came home, Irene was dressing. She seemed sad and vague, and he brought her a drink. They were dining with friends in the neighborhood, and they walked to where they were going. It was one of those splendid spring evenings that excite memory and desire. And the air that touched their hands and faces felt very soft. A Salvation Army band was on the corner playing.
They're really such nice people, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They have such nice faces. Actually, they're so much nicer than a lot of people we know.
She took a bill out of her purse and walked over and dropped it into the tambourine. There was, in her face when she returned to her husband, a look of radiant melancholy that he was not familiar with. And her conduct at the dinner party seemed strange to him, too. She interrupted her hostess.
I don't agree with you. I think you're absolutely wrong. Completely wrong.
Stared at people across the table from her with an intensity for which she would have punished her children. She waited that night until Jim had fallen asleep and then went into the living room and turned on the radio.
Absolutely dead.
Well, maybe if we could get home one night in the week before 1 o'clock, you wouldn't be so tired.
I know, but we had to go to the party, and I don't want to play that.
The next day, she had a slight headache and didn't keep an appointment she had. At 2 o'clock, Jim called her from the office.
Everything all right?
Yes, I suppose so.
Aren't you feeling well?
I've got a bit of a headache.
Oh. What'd you find out about the car?
No, I didn't.
Well, I asked you to be sure to, honey. We won't get it until tomorrow now. Now, will you please call them right away and tell them I've got to have it by tomorrow?
Yes.
Irene, did you hear me?
I said yes.
What's the matter with you?
I've got a headache.
You've been listening to that radio all morning, haven't you? Now, look, fun's fun, but you're running it into the ground, honey. It's not good for you. Now, please, keep the thing off, will you?
All right.
You promise?
All right.
Jim came home at about 6 that night. Emma, the maid, let him in, and he had taken off his hat and was taking off his coat when Irene ran into the hall.
Go up to 16C, Jim.
What?
Don't take off your coat. Go up to 16C. Mr. Osborne's beating his wife. They've been quarreling since 4 o'clock, and now he's hitting her. Go up there and stop it.
Cut it out. Stop it. You don't have to listen to this sort of thing, you know. It's indecent. It's like looking in windows. You know you don't have to listen to this sort of thing. You can just turn it off.
Horrible. It's so dreadful. I've been listening all day.
Honey, why do you listen to it? Why? I bought the filthy thing to give you some pleasure. I paid a lot for it. I thought it might make you happy. I wanted to make you happy.
No. Don't quarrel with me, please. Please. All the others have been quarreling all day. Everybody's quarreling. They're all worried about money. Mrs. Hutchinson's mother is dying in Florida, and they don't have enough money to send her to the Mayo Clinic. And Mrs. Melville has heart trouble, and some woman is playing around with the superintendent. It's disgusting. And Mr. Hendricks is going to lose his job. And that girl who plays the Missouri Waltz all the time. And Mr. Osborne meeting Mrs. Osborne.
Irene, listen to me. Why do you have to turn it on? Why do you have to listen to that stuff? It makes you so miserable.
No, don't. Don't. Life is too terrible. It's too sordid and too awful. But we've never been like that, have we, darling? Have we? I mean, we've always been good and decent and loving, haven't we? And we have 2 children. Beautiful children. Our lives aren't sordid, are they, darling? Are they? We're happy, aren't we? We are happy.
Of course we're happy, darling. Of course. Now, look, I'll have the fool radio fixed or taken away tomorrow. Come on. It's all right, honey. It's all right.
You love me, don't you? And we're not hypercritical or worried about money or dishonest, are we?
No.
A man came in the morning and fixed the radio. And Irene was happy to hear a recording of the Beethoven 9th, including Schiller's Ode to Joy. She kept the radio on all day, and nothing untoward came from the speaker. Debussy's La Mer was being played when Jem came home and they went into dinner. His face was pale, she thought.
I paid the bill for the radio today. It cost $400. I just hope you get some enjoyment out of it.
I'm sure I will, darling.
$400 is a good deal more than I can afford. But I wanted to get something you'd enjoy. It's the last extravagance we'll be able to indulge ourselves in this year.
All right, dear. Of course, I understand.
Maureen, by the way, I noticed you hadn't paid your clothing bills yet. I saw them on your dressing table.
Oh, I suppose I must have forgotten.
Well, why did you tell me you'd paid them? Why did you lie to me?
Well, I just didn't want to worry you, Jim. I'll be able to pay my bills out of this month's allowance. There were slip covers last month and that party we had to give.
Well, you just got to learn to handle the money I give you a little more intelligently, are you?
Yes, darling, I will. I really will.
You just got to understand that we won't have as much money this year as we had last, eh? I had a very sobering talk with Mitchell today. No one's buying anything. We're spending all our time promoting new issues, and you know how long that takes. I'm not getting any younger, you know. I'm 37, and I haven't done as well as I hoped I'd do. I don't suppose things will get any better.
Yes, dear.
We just got to start cutting down. Start thinking of the children. Perfectly frank with you, I worry about money a great deal. I'm not at all sure of the future. No one is. I've worked very hard to give you and the children a comfortable life, and I don't like to see all that energy wasted in fur coats, radios, and slip covers.
Please, Jim, please, they'll hear us.
Who'll hear us? Emma can't hear us.
The radio.
Radio. I'm sick of it. I'm sick to death of you. That radio can't hear us. Nobody can hear us. And what if they can hear us? Who cares? Why are you so holier than thou all of a sudden? What's turned you overnight into a nice girl? You stole your mother's jewelry before they probated a will. You never gave your sister a cent of that money that was intended for her. Not even when she needed it.
Irene stood for a minute before the hideous radio.
This
graced and sickened. But she held her hand on the switch before she extinguished the music, hoping that the instrument might speak to her kindly, that she might hear the Sweeney's nurse. And as she turned the dial, the voice on the radio was suave and noncommittal.
Buffalo. A fire in a hospital near Buffalo for the care of blind children was put out early this morning. There were several injuries, but no fatalities. And that's the news. The temperature downtown is 64. Humidity, 90. And now an interlude of music. The CBS Radio Workshop has presented The Enormous Radio by John Cheever, produced and directed by Anthony Ellis. The script was adapted for radio by Mr. Ellis. The cast included William Conrad, Virginia Gregg, Stacey Harris, Eve McVeigh, Hans Conried, Charlotte Lawrence, Joseph Kearns, Paula Winslow, Herb Butterfield, Helen Klebe, George Walsh, and Irene Tedrow. Special effects were by Robert Chadwick, Bill James, and Clark Casey. This is Hugh Douglas inviting you to join us again next week when from New York we present a special production by the Helen Hayes Drama Group, Lovers, Villains, and Fools, with the famous actress as narrator. The title of the piece is derived from the three principal categories of character portrayals, which are basic equipment for which members of this theater group strive. The narration is written by Albert G. Miller. Special music has been composed and will be conducted by Alex Steinert. That's next week on the CBS Radio Workshop. How many people are there in a crowd of 10 million? Do you have any picture in your mind, or is that figure too overwhelming? Well, 10 million is more people than there are in Chicago, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles combined. And that's how many men, women, and children in our country are suffering from some form of mental illness. Yes, 10 million. Among that 10 million, maybe there's someone you know, a neighbor, friend, or a relative.
So you see, mental illness is a problem that concerns us all. And that's why we are all being asked to give to our local mental health campaign to fight mental illness. The best weapon is research. Research to find out how to prevent mental illness. Your doctors can be helped by your dollars. They can learn enough to really lick this number one problem, mental illness. The victims of mental illness need your help desperately. Give to your local mental health campaign. Stay tuned for 5 minutes of CBS News, to be followed on most of these same stations by My Son Jeep. America listens most to the CBS Radio Network.
This is Helen Hayes, and this is a simple story about actors. I guess I know pretty much about actors because I've been one for 50 years.
The CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, the Helen Hayes Drama Group and Helen Hayes present Lovers, Villains, and Fools. Helen Hayes has been known for years as one of the leading actresses of the American stage, and lately as a New York theater. And now on tape, Miss Hayes.
Thank you. I still haven't become accustomed to being a theater. But after all these years inside of theaters, I'm quite at home when talking about actors and acting. As I said a moment ago, this is a story about actors. Throughout history, strange opinions have been held about actors by people outside the profession, people sometimes known to theater folk as civilians. Actors have been accused of being childlike, vain, feather-brained, irresponsible, and... well, sometimes not even quite respectable. But whatever else they are, actors are artists. They work hard to learn their trade. It isn't easy to be called on to be a lover for one instant and a villain the next, and then turn from being a villain into a fool. And so an actor reaches for Shakespeare, whose plays provide him with all the examples of character he will ever need, no matter whatever or wherever he plays. Tonight, Jack Manning, my young actor friend, has brought our group to the studio with a Shakespearean repertoire of lovers, villains, and fools. And it might be wise to begin foolishly with a fool. The actor will be Dick Vere, reading a speech of Launce, a foolish fellow and two gentlemen of Verona. Launce is the clownish servant of Proteus, one of the two gentlemen. He is especially appreciated for his soliloquies to his dog, Crab, the sourest-natured dog that lives. The stage direction, enter Launce, leading a dog.
Oh, when a man's servant shall play the cur with him, look you, it goes hard. One that I brought up of a puppy, one that I saved from drowning when three or four of his blind brothers and sisters went to it. I have taught him, as you might say, precisely. Thus I would teach a dog. I was sent to deliver him as a present to Mistress Sylvia from my master. And I came no sooner into the dining chamber, but he steps me to her trencher and steals her capon's leg. Oh, 'tis a foul thing when a cur cannot keep himself in all companies. If I had not had more wit to take a fault upon me that he did, I think verily he'd have been hanged for it. Sure as I live, he'd have suffered for it. You shall judge. He thrust me himself into the company of 3 or 4 gentlemanlike dogs under the Duke's table. He'd not been there, bless the mark, but all the chamber smelt him. Out with the dog, says one. Whew. What cur is that, says another. Whip him out, says a third.
Hang him up, says the Duke.
Well, I, having been acquainted with the smell before, knew it was crab. And goes me to the fellow that whips the dogs. Friend, quoth I, do you mean to whip the dog?
Aye, marry I do, quoth he.
You do him the more wrong, quoth I. 'Twas I did the thing you wot of. He makes me no more ado, but whips me out of the chamber. How many masters would do this for their servant? Oh, thou thinkest not on this now. Nay, I remember the trick thou served me when I took my leave of Madam Sylvia. Did I not bid thee still mark me and do as I do? When didst thou ever see me heave up my leg against a gentlewoman's farthingale? Didst thou ever see me do such a trick?
Certain people may think it's easy for an actor to play a fool because they fondly believe that an actor is a fool to begin with. Well, is he really? Certainly an actor does his work earnestly and honestly. Mr. J.B. Priestley, the author, has this to say. I prefer acting that I see in the theater, says Mr. Priestley, to acting that I see in the Harley Street Consulting Room, in the law courts, or the Houses of Parliament. The man who openly plays a character part for 2 hours a night is more likely to remain in a healthy state of mind than the man who plays a character part day and night, using every room he enters as his stage. So much for who is the fool. Now, in Twelfth Night, Shakespeare tells a story of lovers and demonstrates his fondness for disguising his heroine as a boy, thus fooling a lovesick swain. Joseph Warren plays the Duke, and Terry Clark plays Viola.
Give me some music. Come, the song we had last night. Mark it, Cesario. It is old and plain. The spinsters and the knitters in the sun and the free maids that weave their thread with bones do used to chant it. It is silly, sooth. And dallies with the innocence of love, like the old age. Come hither, boy. How dost thou like this tune?
It gives a very echo to the seat where love is throned.
Thou dost speak masterly. My life upon it, young though thou art, thine eye hath stayed upon some favor that it loves. Hath it not, boy?
A little, by your favor.
What kind of woman is't?
Of your complexion.
She is not worth thee, then. What years, i'faith?
About your years, my lord.
Too old, by heaven. Let thy love be younger than thyself, or thy affection cannot hold the bent. For women are as roses whose fair flower, being once displayed, doth fall at very hour.
And so they are. Alas, that they are so, to die even when they to perfection grow.
Once more, Cesario, get thee to yon same sovereign cruelty.
But if she cannot love you, sir.
I cannot be so answered.
Oh, sooth, but you must. Say that some lady, as perhaps there is, hath for your love as great a pang of heart as you have for Olivia. You cannot love her, you tell us, so must she not then be answered?
There is no woman's sides can bide the beating of so strong a passion as love doth give my heart.
Aye, but I know.
What dost thou know?
Too well what love women to men may owe. In faith, they are as true of heart as we. My father had a daughter, loved a man, as might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should your lordship.
And what's her history?
A blank, my lord. For she never told her love, but let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek. She pined and thought, and with a green and yellow melancholy, she sat like patience on a monument, smiling at grief. Was not this love indeed? Oh, we men may say more, swear more, but indeed our shows are more than will, for still we prove much in our vows, but little in our love.
But died thy sister of her love, my boy?
I am all the daughters of my father's house, and all the brothers, too, and yet I know not. Sir, shall I to this lady?
Aye, that's the theme. To her in haste. Give her this jewel. Say, my love can give no place. Bide no denay.
The players who are illustrating this story about actors are all young. They're all artists, and they all make their living by acting on stage, screen, radio, or television. They formed their group because they felt a desperate need to learn their craft well by working. And they chose to study and perform Shakespeare because Shakespeare is the one dramatist who challenges every mood, every skill, and every emotion. Being human beings as well as actors, there are lovers among these young people, I'm certain of that, and there may be a fool or two, but I'm sure that there are no out-and-out villains. Actors leave pure villainy to the drama critics, but they can quickly assume the villain's sneer when the part calls for it. Villainous roles such as Gloucester in King Henry VI, Part II. Here's Jack Manning as Gloucester, the man who can smile and murder while he smiles.
Aye. Edward will use women honorably. Would he were wasted, marrow, bones, and all, that from his loins no hopeful branch may spring to cross me from the golden time I look for. And yet, between my soul's desire and me, the lustful Edward's title buried, is Clarence Henry, and his son young Edward, and all the unlooked-for issue of their bodies to take their rooms ere I can place myself. A cold premeditation for my purpose. Why then, I do but dream on sovereignty. Say there is no kingdom then for Richard. What other pleasures can the world afford? I'll make my heaven in a lady's lap, and deck my body in gay ornaments, and witch sweet ladies with my words and looks. Miserable thought. And more unlikely than to accomplish 20 golden crowns. My love forswore me in my mother's womb. She did corrupt frail nature with some bribe to shrink mine arm up like a withered shrub, to make an envious mountain on my back where sits deformity to mock my body, to shape my legs of an unequal size, to disproportion me in every part like to a chaos or an unlicked bear whelp that carries no impression like the dam. And am I, then, a man to be beloved? A monstrous fault to harbor such a thought. Then, since this earth affords no joy to me but to command, to check, to o'erbear such as are of better person than myself, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown. And whiles I live, to account this world but hell, until my misshaped trunk that bears this head be round impaled with a glorious crown. And yet, I know not how to get the crown. For many lives stand between me and home, and I, like one, lost in a thorny wood that rends the thorns and is rent with the thorns, seeking a way and straying from the way, not knowing how to find the open air, but toiling desperately to find it out, torment myself to catch the English crown. And from that torment I will free myself or hew my way out with a bloody axe. Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile and cry content to that which grieves my heart and wet my cheek with artificial tears and frame my face to all occasions. I can add color to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this and cannot get a crown? Tut, were it further off, I'll pluck it down. This is Jack Manning. In Shakespeare, as in life, we find lovers who are villains. And by being villains are fools indeed. Here are Macbeth and his lady passionately plotting the death of Duncan. Barbara Joyce as Lady Macbeth and Douglas Gordon as Macbeth.
Oh, now, what news?
He has almost supped. Why have you left the chamber?
Have they asked for me?
No, you not, he has.
We will proceed no further in this business. He hath honored me of late, and I have bought golden opinions from all sorts of people, which would be worn now in their newest gloss, not cast aside so soon.
Was the hope drunk wherein you dressed yourself? Hath it slept since? And wakes it now to look so green and pale at what it did so freely? From this time such I account thy love. Art thou afeard to be the same in thine own act and valor as thou art in desire? Wouldst thou have that which thou esteemest the ornament of life and live a coward in thine honesty?
Prithee, peace! I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none.
What beast was it then that made you break this enterprise to me? When you durst do it, then you were a man. And to be more than what you were, you would be so much more the man.
If we should fail.
We fail. But screw your courage to the sticking place, and we'll not fail. When Duncan is asleep, whereto the rather shall his day's hard journey soundly invite him, his two chamberlains will I with wine and wassail so convince that memory, the warder of the brain, shall be a fume, and the receipt of reason a limbeck only, when in swinish sleep their drenched natures lie as in a death, what cannot you and I perform on the unguarded Duncan?
Bring forth men, children only. For thine undaunted metal should compose nothing but males. Will it not be received, when we have marked with blood those sleepy two of his own chamber, and used their very daggers that they have done?
Who dares receive another, as we shall make our griefs and clamor roar upon his death?
I'm settled, and bend up each corporal agent to this terrible feat. Away, mark the time with fairest show. False face must hide what the false heart doth know.
The greatest ambition of all actors is to play Hamlet, and our acting group is no less ambitious than others. So the climax of our story about actors will be a scene from this greatest play of all, A drama that's a treasure house of lovers, villains, and fools. Appropriately for this working group, the scene opens with Shakespeare's instructions to actors young and old in all lands, in all ages. We know it as Hamlet's advice to the players.
Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of your players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-pated fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who, for the most part, are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise. Pray you, avoid it.
I warrant, Your Honor.
Be not too tame, neither, but let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word to the action. With this special observance. The purpose of playing, both at the first and now, was and is to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature. To show virtue her own feature, scorn his own image, and the very age and body of the time his form and pressure. Oh, there be players that I have seen play, and heard others praise, and that highly, have so strutted and bellowed that I have thought some of nature's journeymen had made men and not made them well they imitated humanity so abominably.
I hope we have reformed that indifferently with us, sir.
Oh, reform it altogether. And let those that play your clowns speak no more than is set down for them. For there be of them that will themselves laugh to set on some quantity of barren spectators to laugh too, though in the meantime some necessary question of the play be then to be considered. That's villainous. And shows a most pitiful ambition in the fool that uses it. Go, make you ready. What ho, Horatio?
Here, sweet lord, at your service.
Horatio, there is a play tonight before the king. One scene of it comes near the circumstance which I have told thee of my father's death. I prithee, when thou seest that act afoot, even with the very comment of thy soul, observe my uncle. Give him heedful note. For I, mine eyes, will rivet to his face, and after, we will both our judgments join in censure of his seeming.
Well, my lord, if he steal aught the whilst this play is playing and scape detecting, I will pay the theft.
They are coming to the play. I must be idle. Get you a place.
How fares our cousin Hamlet?
Excellent, i'faith. I eat the air, promise crammed. You cannot feed capons so.
I have nothing with this answer, Hamlet. These words are not mine.
No, nor mine now. Be the players ready.
Aye, my lord. They stay upon your patience.
Come hither, my dear Hamlet. Sit by me.
No, good mother. Here's metal more attractive.
You are merry, my lord.
Why?
Aye, my lord.
Oh, God, you're only jig maker. What should a man do but be merry? For look you, how cheerfully my mother looks. And my father died within his 2 hours.
Nay, 'tis twice 2 months, my lord.
So long? Oh, heavens, died 2 months ago and not forgotten yet. Well, then there's hope a great man's memory may outlive his life half a year. Come, the play.
Enter the king and queen very lovingly, the queen embracing him and he her. She kneels and makes show of protestation unto him. He takes her up and declines his head upon her neck, lays him down upon a bank of flowers. She, seeing him asleep, leaves him.
Madam, how like you this play?
The lady doth protest too much, methinks.
Ah, but she'll keep her word.
Have you heard the argument? Is there no offense in it?
No, no, they do but jest. Poison in jest. No offense of the world.
What do you call the play?
The Mousetrap. This play is the image of a murder done in Vienna. You shall see anon. 'Tis a knavish piece of work. But what of that? Your Majesty and we that have free souls, it touches us not. Come the play.
Anon, comes in Othello, takes off the king's crown, kisses it, and pours poison in the king's ears and exits. The queen returns, finds the king dead, and makes passionate action. The poisoner woos the queen with gifts. She seems loath and unwilling a while, but in the end accepts his love.
The king rises!
What? Frighted with false fire?
Affairs, my lord!
Give all the play!
Give me some light! Away!
Light! Light!
Light!
Light! Light!
Light!
Light!
Go
good Horatio.
Aye, my lord.
I'll take the ghost's word for 1,000 pounds. Didst perceive?
Very well, my lord.
Upon the talk of the poisoning.
I did very well note him.
Leave me, Horatio. 'Tis now the very witching time of night, when churchyards yawn and hell itself breathes out contagion to this world. Now could I drink hot blood and do such bitter business as the day would quake to look on. Soft. Now to my mother. O heart, lose not thy nature. Let not ever the soul of Nero enter this firm bosom. Let me be cruel, not unnatural. I will speak daggers to her, but use none.
Hamlet, thou hast thy father much offended.
Mother, you have my father much offended.
Come, come, you answer with an idle tongue.
Go, go, you question with a wicked tongue.
Why, how now, Hamlet?
What's the matter now?
Have you forgot me?
No, by the rood, not so. You are the queen, your husband's brother's wife. And would 'twere not so, you are my mother.
Nay, then, I'll set those to you who can speak.
Come, sit you down. You shall not budge. You go not till I set you up a glass where you may see the inmost part of you.
What wilt thou do? Thou wilt not murder me.
Leave wringing your hands. Peace, sit you down. And let me wring your heart. For so I shall, if it be made of penetrable stuff. If damned custom have not brazed it so that it is proof and bulwark against sense.
What have I done that thou darest wag thy tongue and noise so rude against me?
Look here, upon this picture and on this, the counterfeit presentment of two brothers. See what a grace was seated on this brow. A combination and a form indeed, where every god did seem to set his seal to give the world assurance of a man. This was your husband. Look you now what follows. Here is your husband, like a mildewed ear, blasting his wholesome brother. Have you eyes? Oh, shame. Where is thy blush?
No, Hamlet, speak no more. These words like daggers in mine ears. No more, sweet Hamlet.
A murderer and a villain, a slave that is not 20th part the tithe of your precedent lord.
No more.
A king of shreds and patches.
I am thy father's ghost.
Save me, and hover o'er me with your wings, you heavenly gods. What would your gracious figure?
Alas, he's mad.
Do you not come, your tardy son, to chide that lapsed in time and passion lets go by the important acting of your dread command? Oh, say.
Do not forget, this visitation is but to whet thine almost blunted purpose. But look, amazement on thy mother sits. Oh, step between her and her fighting soul. Conceit in weakest bodies strongest works. Speak to her, Hamlet.
How is't with you, lady?
Alas, how is't with you? That you do bend your eye on vacancy, and with the incorporeal air do hold discourse. Whereon do you look?
On him, look you, how pale he glares.
To whom do you speak this?
Do you see nothing there?
Nothing at all. Yet all there is I see.
Nor did you nothing hear?
No, nothing but ourselves.
Why, look you there, look how it steals away. My father, in his habit as he lived. Look where he goes even now, out at the portal.
This is the very coinage of your brain. This bodiless creation, ecstasy, is very cunning in.
Ecstasy? Mother, for love of grace, lay not that flattering unction to your soul that not your trespass but my madness speaks. Confess yourself to heaven. Repent what's past. Avoid what is to come, and do not spread the compost on the weeds to make them rancor.
Oh, Hamlet, thou hast cleft my heart in twain.
Throw away the worser part, and live the purer with the other half. Good night. But go not to my uncle's bed. Refrain tonight, and that shall lend a kind of easiness to the next abstinence, the next more easy. Once more, good night. And when you are desirous to be blessed, I'll blessing beg of you. Good night.
Good night, Hamlet.
Good night, Mother.
This has been a story about actors and actors at work. Our revels now are ended. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. Good night, everyone.
The CBS Radio Workshop has presented the Helen Hayes Drama Group with Helen Hayes on tape in Lovers, Villains, and Fools, produced and directed by Paul Roberts. Narration was written by Albert Miller. Music composed and conducted by Alexander Steinert. Heard with Miss Hayes were Jack Manning, Dick Via, Barbara Joyce, Joe Warren, Terry Clark, Douglas Gordon, Betty Ellen, and Arthur Anderson. This is Bob Hite inviting you to join us again next week when, from Hollywood, we present a delightful and thrilling fairy tale by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry called The Little Princess. This is the CBS Radio Network.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy what I'm doing, I ask you to please subscribe to my channel or channels. Well, hope you enjoyed, and until next time, stay safe, wish you well, peace.